Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where Robert Bryce makes a welcome first-up appearance at the Sydney Institute. Mr. Bryce's visit to Australia has been sponsored by the Minerals Council of Australia, and we're delighted to have him on here this evening at the Gallipoli Club. Now, Robert Bryce has been writing professionally about energy, innovation and other topics for nearly three decades. He's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and his articles have appeared in dozens of publications, including The Wall Street Journal, The New York Times, The Guardian, Bloomberg, View and Counterpunch, and he's also appeared regularly on such outlets as the BBC, Fox and CNN. In 2010, Robert Bryce published Power Hungry, The Myths of Green Energy and the Real Fuels of the Future, and he's in Australia at the moment to coincide with the recent publication of his book, Smaller, Faster, Lighter, Denser, Cheaper, How Innovation Keeps Proving the Catastrophist Wrong, which was published as recently as May. And there are copies of that book available after the talk. And tonight, Robert Bryce is going to talk for us on the briefer topic, Proving the Catastrophist Wrong, Energy Innovation. Mr. Bryce, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here. I have 4 points to make, and I'll make them in about 30 minutes. And my topic, as Jared said, is energy innovation proving the catastrophists wrong. So my 4 points. First, modern-day Malthus. Second, superfuels and super engines. Third, the scale challenge. And finally, nuclear, solar, and storage. My first point, modern-day Malthus. In 2005, Lee Raymond, who was then the chairman and the CEO of ExxonMobil, declared, quote, gas production has peaked in North America. What's happened since then? Well, last year, the U.S. produced a record 24.3 trillion cubic feet of natural gas, an increase of 34% over the level achieved in 2005 when Raymond made his statement. Now, to be clear, Raymond, I'm not saying was a Malthusian or is a Malthusian, but his statement is indicative of a broad school of thought that we're running out, that we don't have enough energy, we don't have enough food. For instance, a century ago, in 1914, a U.S. government agency, the Bureau of Mines, predicted that world oil supplies would be depleted within 10 years. 1956, M. King Hubbert, a Shell geophysicist who became famous for his forecast known as Hubbert's Peak, predicted that gas production in the United States would peak at about 38 billion cubic feet by 1970. 38 billion cubic feet per day, forgive me, in 1970. 1972, the Club of Rome published The Limits to Growth, which predicted the world would be out of oil by 1992 and out of natural gas by 1993. Or consider this statement, which I just found on Climate Change Australia's website. Quote, climate change makes carbon reduction essential. Peak oil makes it inevitable. And of course, we've heard similar dire predictions about food supplies. 1798, the Englishman Thomas Malthus published his famous essay, An Essay on the Principle of Population. In it, he said, population growth, quote, is indefinitely greater than the power of the earth in the earth to produce substance for man. In 1968, Paul Ehrlich published The Population Bomb, or he wrote The Population Bomb, a book that was published by the Sierra Club, the largest environmental group in the United States. In the book, Ehrlich claimed, quote, the battle to feed all of humanity is over. In the 1970s, hundreds of millions of people will starve to death in spite of any crash programs embarked upon now. At this late date, nothing can be done to prevent a substantial increase in the world death rate. 6 years later, in 1974, Ehrlich declared, quote, that within the next quarter of a century, mankind will be looking elsewhere than in oil wells for its main source of energy. What happened? Let's look at energy. In 1980, the world had about 683 billion barrels of proved reserves of oil. Between 1980 and 2013, global proved oil reserves increased from about 683 billion barrels to nearly 1.7 trillion barrels, 2.5 times the level forecasted in 1980. That reserve growth occurred despite the fact that over that three-decade period, we globally consumed roughly 800 billion barrels of oil. In other words, over the past three decades or so, we have consumed more oil than analysts thought was available in 1980, and not only that, we've doubled the amount of proved reserves globally. Similar reserve growth has occurred in natural gas. Between 1980 and 2013, reserves increased from about 72 trillion cubic meters to roughly 186 trillion cubic meters. And those reserves increased, even though during that same time period, globally, we consumed roughly 77 trillion cubic meters of gas. Innovation. Innovation has allowed us to do something truly remarkable, which is the more oil and gas we find, the more oil and gas we find. Now, what about food? Back in 1968, Ehrlich, professor at Stanford, predicted starvation for millions of people. And in that year, the global population was 3.5 billion people. Today, global population is roughly 7 billion people, and yet the death rate today is lower than it was in 1968. Since 1950, the global food supply per capita has increased by roughly 30%, even though the amount of arable land per capita has fallen by about half. Why are we producing more food? Well, clearly, better farming techniques, GPS-guided planting systems, hybrid seeds, and perhaps most importantly, the perfection of the Haber-Bosch process. Our ability to convert natural gas and atmospheric nitrogen into ammonia is probably the single most important invention in history. In 1970, in a speech he gave while accepting the Nobel Peace Prize, Norman Borlaug, the father of the Green Revolution, declared, quote, "If the high-yielding dwarf wheat and rice varieties are the catalysts that have ignited the Green Revolution, then chemical fertilizer is the fuel that has provided its forward thrust." Increased food and energy production has fostered an unprecedented era of peace and prosperity. Now, I will gladly stipulate that we have plenty of conflict and plenty of poverty. We have shooting wars from Damascus to Donetsk. In Africa and in southern Asia, we have hundreds of millions of people continuing to live in squalor. But today, by nearly any objective measure, it is easily provable that we have more people living today freer, healthier, longer lives than at any time in human history. Since the 1970s, the number of countries that are considered free has nearly doubled. Income levels among the poorest of the poor are steadily rising. Literacy rates, particularly among women and girls, are rising. In 1950, a little more than half of the adults on the planet were literate. Today, about 90% of all adults on the planet are literate. A century ago, few women were allowed to vote. Today, women are allowed to vote, or are voting rather, in nearly every country in the world, with the obvious exceptions being the Islamic countries such as Saudi Arabia. In the 2012 Summer Olympics in London, for the first time, all of the countries taking part in the games had women on their teams, and those women were competing. Why are we prospering like never before? In my view, it is clearly our ability to use more energy. We are using and harnessing more energy, and we are turning that energy into useful power. Remember, energy is the ability to do work powerfully. power is the rate at which work is done. We are using energy to create motive power, which is allowing people unprecedented mobility. Lighting power is allowing people all over the world to defeat the darkness and therefore to study and work at night. Electrical power and digital communications are allowing the unprecedented interchange of ideas all over the world. For the first time, people here in Australia, people in the United States, can contact nearly anyone else on the planet and do so for nearly free. It is a remarkable turn of events. It is our ability to harness energy and turn it into useful power that is fostering this unprecedented wave of prosperity. It is driven by the inexorable human desire for smaller, faster, lighter, denser, cheaper. Yes, that's the title of my new book. I think I came all the way here to Australia just to look at Sydney Harbor? No. Tell your friends, tell your neighbors, you don't have to read it, you just have to buy it. By the way, I've written 5 books. My first book was on Enron. Collect them all. They make great gifts. And if you buy it for your Kindle, I make a better royalty. Okay. End of my commercial. My second point, superfuels and super engines. Throughout our history here on this planet, we've gotten better and better at capturing energy and converting it into power. And that improving ability, capturing and converting energy, is the basis of all modern society. For centuries, we were limited by what we could physically harness from the wind, the water, or the sun, whether that was a sailing vessel or a water wheel, or biomass that we fed to draft animals, or food that we ate ourselves that we could then use as energy to hunt and farm. Those were our only options for doing work. The energy density of the fuels was invariably low. The fuels were highly variable, both geographically and seasonally, and the conversion devices that we had were hugely inefficient. And then came the innovators, specifically Newcomen and Watt. And suddenly, and I do mean suddenly, hydrocarbons freed us from the vagaries of the sun, the wind, and the rain. Harnessing coal in steam engines fostered the Industrial Revolution. And ever since the time of Newcomen and Watt, we have been on an unending quest to use ever better fuels and ever better engines. We've gone from feeding grass and oats to horses and oxen to using jet fuel and uranium in turbines and reactors. Despite this, there is a bias in the media and a bias in among politicians and pundits toward innovation in solar and wind energy, batteries, etc., and so-called clean energy. Now, there have been no doubt that we have seen major advances in those areas, but that bias ignores the tremendous amount of momentum and capital behind the hydrocarbon sector. Let's look at the numbers. Last year, according to Bloomberg New Energy Finance, global spending on renewables was roughly $250 billion. That's a lot of money. But global spending on oil and gas drilling alone, I'm not talking about refining or transportation of oil and gas. Oil and gas drilling alone, expenditures last year this year will be roughly $1.3 trillion. That's 4 times more than global spending on renewables. In the U.S. alone, spending on the upstream sector and the oil and gas sector, that's the drilling sector, is roughly $300 billion. The U.S. alone spends more drilling oil and gas wells than is currently spent globally on all renewables. And all of that spending has fostered innovation. Over the past century, the oil and gas industry has gone from a business dominated by wildcatters operating on a hunch and a prayer and to a business today that is more akin to precision manufacturing in automobiles and aerospace. Modern drilling rigs are so good, they can punch a hole in the earth, go down 2 miles, turn left, and go out another 2 miles and arrive within a few inches of the targeted zone. The innovation in offshore energy production has been even more impressive. In 1947, the oil industry drilled the Kermack 16. It was the first well drilled out of the side of land offshore. The well was drilled in 20 feet of water at a location about 43 miles south of Morgan City, Louisiana. Now, back in 1947, the deep water resources that are now being exploited in the Gulf of Mexico or offshore Western Australia and elsewhere may as well have been located on the dark side of the moon. For all practical purposes, they did not exist because we did not have the technology available to exploit them. But new submarines, GPS-enabled positioning systems, robots, and major advances in material science are helping unlock enormous quantities of hydrocarbons. Why are we so avid? Why are we so avid in the pursuit of oil? Why was BP out in the deep water in the Gulf of Mexico exploring for the deep with the Deepwater Horizon, and of course with the accident that we saw after that? Why are companies like Chevron operating in Western Australia in the Gorgon field spending tens of billions of dollars? Why are they out there? Because oil is a super fuel. If oil didn't exist, we would have to invent it. No other fuel can match oil when it comes to cost, scale, ease of handling, flexibility. Oil is a super fuel, and we are using that super fuel in super engines. The Ford Model T, launched in 1908, had a 2.9-liter engine that produced 22 horsepower. Today, Ford is selling a super engine. It is the 1-liter EcoBoost. It produces 123 horsepower, 92,000 watts per liter of displacement. That's 16 times the volumetric power density that was found in the Model T. It's also roughly the same power density as what's found in the engine of the Bugatti Veyron, a supercar that costs $1.2 million, if you can get it, if you can get one. And yet you can buy the 1-liter EcoBoost engine in a Ford Fiesta that costs about $15,000. Equally remarkable, the 1-liter EcoBoost produces 8 times more power per unit of weight and is about 3 times as fuel efficient as the engine that was in the Model T. Super engines, we carry super computing engines today in our pockets. 1978, I graduated from high school in Tulsa, Oklahoma. It was the same year that Intel released the 8086 processor, the brain for the first wave of personal computers. The 8086 processor had 29,000 transistors on circuits that were 3 microns wide. Today, Intel's flagship processor, the Core i7, has 2.3 billion transistors. Between 1978 and today, Intel has increased the computing power density on its best chips 78,000-fold and decreased the size of its circuits 130-fold. Over the past 4 decades, the per-transistor price for Intel's microprocessors has dropped by a factor of 50,000. And the amount of power consumed per transistor has dropped by a factor of 5,000. That's a computing engine. Computing engines that we carry around in our pockets that we now use every day and we don't think a thing about them. This iPhone has 250,000 times the digital storage capacity of the computer that went to the moon on board Apollo 11. And today, energy companies of all kinds are using massive computers so that we can produce even more energy. Automobile companies are using massive computers to design even better engines that are more fuel efficient, emit fewer pollutants, and are more powerful than the engines that came before. Super engines and super fuels are a reality today, and as we move forward, we will exploit even more super fuels and super engines. Now, clearly I'm talking about innovation, but I'm leading to my next point, which is the scale challenge. I am bullish on the future. I am bullish on the future of Australia. I'm bullish on the future of the United States for obvious reasons. Educated populations. A favorable geography, an incredible abundance of natural resources. But our challenge today globally is the scale challenge, my third point. My thesis, as I've said, is that our ability to exploit energy is proving the catastrophes wrong, but I am not glib about the challenges that we face. And the challenge that we face today is specifically, how do we sustain this incredible prosperity that we've achieved? But further, how do we bring more people out of the dark and into the modern world. According to the World Bank, today at least 1.2 billion people, roughly 20% of the world's population, don't have access to electricity. Another 2.8 billion people, 40% of the world's population, are still using solid fuels like coal, dung, and wood for their cooking and heating needs inside their homes. And every year, smoke and pollutants from poor quality stoves and open cooking fires kill roughly 1.5 million people, most of them women and girls. They die by the thousands in poor countries from emphysema and other respiratory diseases due to poor indoor air quality caused by lousy cooking stoves. Where will we get the energy that we need? Therein lies the challenge. But if we are to meet that challenge, we have to understand the tyranny of big numbers. Over the past decade alone, global energy consumption has increased by about 28%, or 56 million barrels of oil equivalent per day. That increase is equal to 7 Saudi Arabias of daily oil production. The public does not understand numbers, and they don't understand basic science. But when it comes to energy, they don't understand units of energy. And it's easy to understand why they don't understand it. We understand that natural gas is sold in cubic feet and in cubic meters. It's sold in BTUs and in gigajoules. VP Statistical Review publishes data in million tons of oil equivalent. Others are published in exajoules. Others are published in gallons, barrels. The public understands oil better than any other commodity, I believe, and so I normalize my energy data around oil. Global energy use today is 256 million barrels of oil equivalent per day. That's 1.5 exajoules, if you like SI units, I do. That's 31 Saudi Arabias per day equivalent. Since the 70s, the Saudis have been producing about 8.3 million barrels of oil per day. So 256 million barrels of oil equivalent, 31 Saudi Arabias, and we get 87% of all of our energy from coal, oil, and natural gas. That's 27 Saudi Arabias from coal, oil, and natural gas. Overall, we get 10 Saudi Arabias from oil, 9 from coal, 7 from natural gas, 2 from hydro, 1.5 from nuclear, and 0.7 Saudi Arabias. 0.7 Saudi Arabias from all the political darlings of the moment, solar, wind, and biomass. Put another way, we get 40 times as much energy from hydrocarbons as we do from solar, wind, and geothermal. Scale, scale, scale. The hard reality is that renewable energy, for whatever its merits, cannot even keep pace with the growth in global hydrocarbon demand, much less displace significant quantities of hydrocarbons. Let me give you an example. In the last year alone, U.S. oil production increased by 1.2 million barrels per day, a remarkable achievement. I'll repeat, last year alone, U.S. oil production rose by 1.2 million barrels per day. Just the increase in U.S. oil production is equal to 2 times the contribution of all global solar. All the global solar installations on the planet, including the 3,200 watts of solar panels on the roof of my house in Austin, Texas, produced the equivalent of 600,000 barrels of oil per day. The reality is, ladies and gentlemen, hydrocarbons are here to stay. And if we want to bring more people out of poverty, we are going to have to rely on hydrocarbons to do so. And to be more specific, we're going to have to rely on coal. Since 1973, coal has grown faster than any other form of energy consumption. Why? Because the world wants electricity. They want what we take for granted. They want cheap, abundant, reliable flows of electricity. And they will use the fuel that is the cheapest, the most abundant, and the most reliable in order to do so. The world wants electricity. No other energy form is as versatile or as powerful. The essentiality of electricity to modernity is incontrovertible. I don't use PowerPoint. Never have. Gives me a rash. Before we're going to show you one slide, one chart from not my new book, my last book, Power Hungry, I'd show you the top 20 countries ranked by GDP and the top 20 countries ranked by electricity generation. The correlation is almost 1-to-1. The countries that can produce cheap, abundant, reliable flows of electricity can build modern economies, educate their citizens, and bring their people out of the dark. And those that can't, can't. Period. Full stop. 1.1 billion Africans use roughly the same amount of electricity as 35 million Canadians. Africa is the dark continent. Why? Because it's dark. Coal is the fuel of today. We don't have to like coal. We don't have to love coal. We can hate coal all we like. But for the developing world in particular, this is the fuel that they're using to produce electricity. Last year alone, global coal use rose by 2 million barrels of oil equivalent per day. That was 50% more than the growth in petroleum and nearly three times the growth seen in natural gas. I'm adamantly pro-natural gas. I'm adamantly pro-nuclear. But coal is growing so incredibly fast, it's hard to get our minds around it. Last December, the International Energy Agency in Paris released a report which said, quote, coal demand knows only one direction, up. By 2018, the IEA is projecting that global coal consumption could exceed global oil consumption on a BTU or per joule basis. It's a remarkable projection. The last time coal consumption exceeded oil consumption in the United States was 1949. What this shows us is the value of coal for producing electricity. I recently completed a paper for Manhattan Institute. It'll be released next month. And I looked at coal, and I looked at the surge in coal use. What were the key takeaway? Between 1990 and 2010, according to the World Bank, roughly 1.7 billion people gained access to electricity. In my paper, in doing the analysis, looking at three different analyses of global coal consumption and electricity use, the punchline is this. Of the 1.7 billion people who gained access to electricity, roughly 800 million gained access due to coal. Roughly 65 million gained access due to solar and wind. Put another way, for every one person who gained access to electricity due to solar and wind, four gained access due to hydro, six got access due to natural gas, and 13 gained access thanks to coal. Okay, my final point. Jared warned me, stay on time or there will be consequences. So I'm going to stay on time. I have 5 minutes. My final point, nuclear, solar, and storage. These are the frontier areas for energy innovation. I'm not going to say much about wind and biofuels. I'm a critical of both. Why? Because the power density of wind and biofuels is too low. Full stop. Power density of wind energy is 1 watt per square meter, period. End of story. Elvis has left the building. I cite six different analyses in this book to show that the power density of wind is 1 watt per square meter. What does that mean? It takes enormous quantities of land. I did an analysis looking here in Australia. You have roughly 30 gigawatts of coal-fired capacity. If you wanted to replace your coal-fired capacity here in Australia with wind turbines, you would need a land area of roughly 30 billion square meters. That's 30,000 square kilometers. That's a land area 2.5 times the size of Greater Sydney. And the punchline is, or the kicker rather, is that the noise produced by those turbines means that you can't have any people living near those turbines. Biofuels, I'm a longtime critic of the corn ethanol scam. The idea that we are burning food to make motor fuel is anathema to me. I think it's immoral. It's craziness. It goes beyond craziness into a realm I can't even describe. The biofuel boom is over. So nuclear. Let me tell you my position on nuclear, and I have this position with full knowledge of what happened at Fukushima. If you are anti-carbon dioxide and anti-nuclear, you are pro-blackout. I am adamantly anti-blackout. My energy policy is clear. I'm for cold beer and air conditioning for everybody. Fukushima will slow the development and deployment of nuclear, but it is not the critical issue for the deployment of nuclear. What is the critical issue? It's cost. Nuclear simply costs too much money. But we will develop better reactors. We're in the process of doing so. Thorium reactors, modular reactors, sodium-cooled reactors. We can't stay away from nuclear. Why? Because of power density. He said the power density of wind energy is 1 watt per square meter. The power density inside the core of a pressurized water reactor is roughly 300 megawatts per square meter. 300 million watts per square meter. We have to get good at nuclear, and we are. But we are just at the beginning of the nuclear age. We've been using coal for 3,000 years. It's been common industrial use for 250 years. The first commercial nuclear reactor was Calder Hall, began operating in 1956, just 4 years before I was born. We can't downplay the problems and the challenges facing nuclear, but we are only 6 decades into the nuclear age, and yet nuclear opponents like Greenpeace and the so-called Greens, such as Friends of the Earth Australia, want to kill the nuclear baby in the crib. We are seeing more innovation, more venture capital flowing into nuclear, but we have to be clear about the challenges. Now, solar and batteries. I mentioned earlier I'm in favor of, I'm bullish on solar. We're seeing huge growth in solar, that growth is going to continue. And let me be clear, I'm opposed to all energy subsidies unless I'm getting them. Why did I put solar panels on the roof of my house? Because the city owned utility and my hometown paid 2/3 of the cost. What am I, stupid? I'm going to take the money. My neighbors come by and say, love your solar panels. I say, thank you. You paid for them. Price of solar is coming down dramatically. We will see rapid deployment of solar. Bloomberg New Energy Finance estimates that by 2030, $2.5 billion will be spent on renewables, and the vast majority of that will go into solar. Now, what about batteries? The short answer is that they're still, I mean, we use them by the billions to power our devices of all kinds, but they're still too finicky, and their energy density is still too low. On a gravimetric basis, on a per weight basis, gasoline contains 80 times the energy found in the best lithium ion batteries. Furthermore, batteries don't like extreme hot or cold, and they aren't very durable. But we are seeing advances in batteries that are used for the stationary market. I'm not bullish on electric vehicles, never have been and won't be. But our ability to store electricity is laughably small. We can store large quantities of coal, oil, and natural gas, but our ability to store electricity, it's a fraction of what our demand is globally for electricity. If we could somehow gather all of the world's car batteries, we have about 1 billion automobiles on the planet, gather them all together, wire them all together, charge them all up, the amount of electricity we could store in all of those car batteries would roughly equal 30 minutes of global electricity use. But we're seeing remarkable developments in battery technology and tremendous quantities of venture capital and investment going into the battery market. In my book, I write about Aquion Energy, a company based in Pittsburgh. They've raised over $100 million in private equity and venture capital, and they have pioneered a battery that uses salt water as the electrolyte. These advances in nuclear, in storage, in solar, all are ongoing along with advances in hydrocarbon extraction and utilization, and all are extremely positive. Going forward, we're going to need more energy, not just more energy, a lot more energy, so that we can bring more people out of the dark. We need more energy, and we need better engines of all kinds so that we can more effectively convert that energy into useful power for whatever kind, computing power, motive power, cooking power. We're not running out of oil. We're not running out of natural gas or uranium. The Malthusians are wrong. They have been wrong. They've been proven wrong over and over again. We have plenty of energy, enough to last centuries. What we are lacking in many wealthy countries, including the United States and Australia and in Western Europe, is the political will to exploit the vast energy resources that we have. We may indeed one day hit peak oil or peak natural gas, but we will never reach peak imagination. Energy is the master resource, but human ingenuity is the ultimate resource. That ingenuity and the innovation that springs from it is what makes me hopeful for the future. I am, as a journalist in Austin once said, optimistic to the point of idiocy. I hope that my remarks here today led you to just be a tad more optimistic as well. Thank you.
Well,
34 minutes, I'm sorry.
That's pretty good. So many thanks to Robert Brass. So I should say thanks to the Gallipoli Club for the use of this facility today. And thanks also to the Minerals Council of Australia for bringing our speaker out here and making it possible for him to address us. And copies of Smaller, Faster, Lighter, Denser, Cheaper are available from Janet Grundy, who's sitting over there. So now we come to questions and comments. You mentioned Thomas Malthus, you mentioned Paul Ehrlich. As you know, they're bright guys. And in Australia, we've got a chap named Tim Flannery, who not so long ago predicted that there would never be substantial rainfall again over our major capital cities, and the dams would never fill soon after Brisbane flooded, but leaving them aside. Why do you think it is that bright guys and women are attracted to catastrophe? I mean, at the start of your talk, you went through a lot of this stuff. What's the appeal of catastrophe? It's obviously not necessarily a scientific appeal, but it must be some kind of psychological appeal. How do you see that?
That's a great question. Sure, of course. I used to work for a guy who had we were talking about this very thing, and he said, you know, some people aren't happy unless they're scared out of their minds. They're not happy unless they're miserable. So I think that there's some part of that there is a germ of truth there, that for a lot of people it sounds smarter to be pessimistic. Oh, you're just, you know, you're Dr. Pangloss, you know, everything's going to be fine. Well, I'm not Dr. Pangloss. I will gladly stipulate we face 1,000 challenges. I could stay up here the rest of the night, all day tomorrow, all day next week, talking about the problems we have, possibility of pandemics, et cetera. But the continued focus on the negative, I think, is a little, again, just being too positive is glib. Being too negative is also glib. And so I think there's just an attraction to this idea that you know, that we're doomed is something that has been with us forever.
Right, so there's a question down there. Yep.
Yes, sir.
Carbon dioxide can't be described in the press these days without being described as pollution when it comes from combustion hydrocarbons. You get as plant food, and I'm just wondering how serious do you take the modelling in relation to global warming and the connection
sure.
between that and CO2 increase?
Sure. You know, I follow the arguments on both sides of the CO2 and climate change debate. And what I've decided is there's no reason for me to get involved in that. I'm a resolute agnostic when it comes to the issue of climate change. Tell me CO2 is good. Tell me it's bad. I'm bored with the nastiness of the argument. Because really all that I see when it comes to the press and the media is, which side are you on? And, oh, you're on that side or you're on this side. And, oh, well, you're for, you know, you work for Big Oil or Big Coal, or you work for Sierra Club or Friends of the Earth or Greenpeace. And that's all we've heard. Which side are you on? Instead of what's the way forward? And that's what I try to do. I mean, and in my last two books, I write about it all the time. If we're serious about CO2 emissions, let's get serious about natural gas and nuclear, because that's the best no regrets policy going forward. But there are a lot of problems in trying to pursue that, because natural gas, it doesn't occur in every country. Nuclear is not appropriate for every country. So I've just stayed out of the climate change debate. And, you know, some people say I'm a denier. They can say whatever they want. But my approach is, if you think CO2 is bad, then what? Tell me what your idea is. Tell me what your plan is. And especially if you think CO2 is bad, does that mean then you're going to go to Islamabad or Jakarta and tell them they can't build coal-fired power plants? Because that's what they're doing. I prefer to focus on the numbers and on the reality, and instead of this, just the nastiness of the argument about which side are you on.
Question down there.
I'm interested in why you're not bullish on electric cars. You follow your thesis through, and there can be continued innovation in hydrocarbon extraction, and then there can be continued innovation.
The question is, why are you not bullish on electric cars?
Well, in my view, electric cars are the next big thing, and they always will be. the history of the electric car is a century of failure, tailgating failure. In my last book, In Power Hungry, I have a picture of an electric car from 1912. We're at 2014. Not only is the energy density terrible in batteries, there's no public pull. you know, I live in the U.S. and we get this inundated with the hype about the Tesla. It's a plaything for the rich. I had the good fortune of interviewing Alan Mulally shortly before he retired from Ford Motor Company. Remarkable executive. Really saved that company from bankruptcy and turned it around. I said, so what about electric cars? He says, well, you know, we just don't think the customers want them. And in the first quarter of this year, 0.07% of all of the Ford cars sold were electric vehicles. So will there be advances in batteries? Yes. Is there a niche market for electric vehicles? Of course. And electric scooters, electric motorcycles, some of those technologies are remarkable. But the advances, what the electric car enthusiasts forget is the incredible advances that are being made in internal combustion engines. I talked about the Ford EcoBoost. Why would you buy an electric car to save a few pennies on fuel when they have now have a car that can get 50 miles per gallon of gasoline, and you don't have to stop when you're driving from here to Perth and let your car recharge for 5 hours. You could go into the gas station and refill in 2 minutes and be on your way. So there are myriad problems with electric vehicles. I'm not saying they won't develop and there won't be more electric cars into the market. There will be, but I think they're going to be a very small niche market.
Question here and then here.
Yeah. We've heard a lot about how things in the field of gas, whatever, innovation and new energy drives are changing America's doldrums, if you like. You know, America's been through a bad patch economically. Can you tell us a bit about how energy development in America is helping the American economy? What's happening?
Sure. The question is about economic impact of shale development in the U.S. The answer is, it's nothing short of remarkable. I was at Purdue University last fall, a well-known engineering school in Indiana, and I spoke with an energy economist there, Wallace Tyner. He and his colleagues produced a report that was published last fall, estimated that the shale revolution in oil and gas production in the United States is now adding 3 percentage points to U.S. GDP. That's an addition to U.S. GDP of $500 billion per year. You add in the employment of new jobs, of hundreds of thousands of new jobs in the American economy due to oil and gas extraction. Add in the savings to the U.S. economy from lower cost natural gas, a savings that is at least $4 per million BTU or per gigajoule. And the savings are on the order of $200 million per day, which is something on the order of $70 billion a year. Imagine what prices would be, not just in the U.S., but here in Australia, around the world, for crude oil if the U.S. hadn't added another 2 million or 2.5 million barrels of new oil production just in the last few years. We're at $100 today. With all the unrest in Syria and the Middle East and elsewhere, it could easily be $150. So the benefits of U.S. oil and gas production are not just accruing to the United States, they're accruing to countries around the world.
And sort of fits my question, but I'll switch it to China instead.
Sure.
To what extent, there's a sort of lively debate in Australia about the transformation of China's economy and including of its energy sources.
Sure.
How do you see that evolving from here, and how rapidly do you see China changing its energy mix? And secondly, what role does China have as a technology power in energy transformation?
In my view, I think China's kind of stuck. I mean, I think that China, particularly relative to Australia and the U.S., is in a bad way because they bet so much of their economy on coal-fired capacity. And I think that the pollution problems that they're having from coal-fired generation are ultimately going to hamper their economy. Now, they know what's good for their own economy, and they're going to develop their coal resources. But I think that despite their efforts to add new nuclear, they've hitched their wagon to so much coal, and the pollution, the air pollutants that are coming from all that coal use, I think are ultimately going to be destructive. Now, is that going to be in the next few years? I don't know. Demographically, I think China's problems over the long term are just as serious as anything having to do with other infrastructure. Their demographics are terrible. Technology, I mean, that is really an interesting question about, can China truly innovate instead of just copying? And that's an open question. I think that's, Yes, I'm from the U.S. I sound like I'm a homer, you know, I'm just talking about... But when you talk about innovation, I think that's where the U.S., Australia, Western Europe have the real advantages, because they foster entrepreneurship and they foster the free flow of information. Ultimately, I think that could be the longer-term problem for China, is their effort, as was once called the Great Firewall, that by James Fallows, an American journalist. He went to China and he tried to get on the internet, and the internet connection speeds are very slow. The Chinese are restricting the flow of information to their people. Well, how do you build an entrepreneurial class if you're not allowing the free flow of information? How do you allow innovation if you're not allowing the free flow of information? So, I mean, everyone talks about the Chinese tiger. I think it's overblown.
Yeah, let me go down behind that. Yeah.
Hi, Robert. Australia is currently going through a discussion on renewable energy.
Sure.
What has been the experience in the US of renewable energy mandates? And I know you've also written about Germany's experience.
Sure. The question is on renewable energy mandates in the US and Germany. There's been a lot of talk in the U.S. about trying to mandate renewables on a nationwide scale. So far, it's really only been done on a state-by-state basis. So, for instance, in the southeastern U.S., there's very little wind capacity or wind resource. So states in the southeastern U.S. have effectively implemented no renewable mandates. California, by contrast, has a 30% target, I think, by 2020, if memory serves. But these have been incredibly expensive. The electric rate increases in California are very similar to what has already occurred in Germany. And in fact, the Californians have taken have followed right in the path of what Germany has done, and I think it's going to be ruinously expensive. It already has been. If you look at what the Energiewende, the energy revolution that has been implemented in Germany, electric prices in Germany have risen 60% in the last 5 years. German industry has gone to the government and said, we have to roll back these renewable mandates because the cost of energy, the cost of electricity in particular, is so high. Average cost of residential electricity in the U.S. is 12 cents a kilowatt hour. In Germany today, it's 36 cents, three times higher. In the last decade, the mandates on renewables in Germany have cost German consumers and business over $100 billion. And the estimates by German officials are that the German government will have to spend as much as $1 trillion between now and 2050 on more subsidizing more renewables. So that's just the electricity side. Meanwhile, the Germans have hitched their entire economy to the kleptocrats in the Kremlin. I mean, they bet their economy on Gazprom and the ability of Gazprom to deliver natural gas into their economy. Now, given what Vladimir Putin has shown already, I think the last thing I would want to do is hitch my economy to Vladimir Putin and Gazprom. And yet that's what they've done. At the same time, they've made electricity more expensive. I think Germany is in a very difficult position.
Question down there.
Robert, the International Energy Agency that you mentioned forecast that in 2050, 23% of greenhouse productions have to come from renewables, but 70% have to come from carbon capture storage. It's associated with coal-fired electricity, gas-fired, because that's only 50% of what, still 50% of what
sure.
coal puts out, and also cement making and steel making. Yet, last year, $250 billion was spent on renewables, $250 billion, and in the last 10 years, $20 billion has been spent on carbon capture storage, and there's already technology
okay.
where CO2 is injected into the ground
sure.
yep.
for enhanced oil recovery, so the technology's there.
Okay.
What's the consequence it's going to be in 2050?
All right. What are the consequences of 2050?
Well,
of all this,
I feel like I'm not bullish on carbon capture and sequestration. There are two problems. One is the enormous volume of CO2 to be captured. In my last book, Power Hungry, I have a graphic in which I showed if you just planned on capturing 10% of CO2 globally, and you were able to somehow capture it, collect it all in one place, liquefy it. That volume of liquefied CO2 would roughly equal the volume of global oil production daily, We're talking about 42 VLCC supertankers of liquefied CO2, then that you have to put somewhere, stuff somewhere down in the ground. Call me crazy, I just don't think that's going to happen. Why? Because we would have to reverse engineer effectively the entire global oil sector's capacity for drilling wells and replicate it in order to shoot a waste product back down in the earth. And no, let's not forget, CO2 is a colorless, odorless gas that's heavier than air. So let's say you live outside Sydney and you live in a valley and some pipeline company says, oh, we want to bring CO2 pipeline right through your valley. Oh, it's colorless, odorless, and heavier than air, and I live in a valley and there's a leak in the pipeline. It doesn't sound so good to me. Add in the enormous costs of carbon capture and sequestration. There's a project underway in Mississippi in the U.S. Southern Company is behind it. The cost overruns they've had on this IGCC, CCS, I should add some more acronyms in here, IGCC, CCS, they're at $9,000 a kilowatt, roughly, for the cost of the plant. It's crazily expensive. So, another thing I'm not bullish on.
There's a question here.
Would you please compare thorium and uranium as a nuclear fuel, and how much thorium is now being introduced into plants throughout the world?
Sure. The amount of thorium introduced into nuclear reactors around the world is infinitesimally small. Brookhaven National Laboratory in the U.S. on Long Island in New York, they're experimenting with thorium. The Indian government has long been active in thorium-related research, but thorium is not claiming any market share in the global reactor market. Now, there are many things to recommend thorium. It's very abundant in the Earth's crust, far more abundant than uranium. It requires minimal processing in order to use it inside the core of a reactor, but you still need plutonium or uranium to start the chain reaction process in the reactor. Thorium also produces, when it's used in the reactor, very few of the actinides in the reactor. So there isn't any plutonium produced when thorium is used in the reactor. So it's a very attractive fuel. But right now, there's no reason to move away from uranium. We have plenty of uranium. If we start reprocessing used fuel, there's even more fuel available. So in my view, we don't really need to necessarily move to thorium. We need to do better at the reactor technologies we have and make them smaller. We need to make them cheaper, and we need to make them safer.
Thank you.
Yeah, welcome.
There's a question here.
With all these energy growth and applications, it requires some smart thinkers somewhere developing new products.
Sure.
Can you comment on how one can tie down on a world scene intellectual property, your IP? Does that happen today? It seems as though there were many leak holes in that.
So you're talking about patent law, international patent law with regard to energy technologies?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I haven't given that much thought at all. I think you've caught me truly flat-footed here. I think that patent law and IP is going to be important, but I think obviously with any deployment of any new technology, it's going to be the ability to capture market share quickly, right? So that you are able to then protect that intellectual property. But I mean, just speaking from what I've seen in oil and gas deployment, oil and gas technology, you know, Schlumberger may have a technology, Halliburton may have a different one, some other company may have one. Somehow that information is getting shared, because they're going to different companies and they may try and protect their secret sauce on a drill bit or a hydraulic fracturing fluid or something. But that technology diffuses into the marketplace pretty rapidly. But, I think that the patent law, that's a better question for lawyers and patent attorneys. And I don't know. Again, you caught me flat-footed on that one.
A political question. In Australia in recent times, we've had this unusual combination in relation to coal seam gas in New South Wales and Queensland, in particular northern New South Wales, southern Queensland, where you've got a combination of opposition coming from what were once regarded as quite conservative farmers.
Sure.
And green activists who have been quite successful in making governments at the state level step back a bit here. But as I understand, that's not the experience in North America, certainly not in the United States. So is there any of this kind of combination of conservative farmers and radical activists going on in in North America?
Well, there have been efforts in the U.S. to align the labor movement and the environmental movement. They call it the blue-green alliance, blue-collar and green alliance. Has it been overly successful? I don't think so. But
what about the farmers?
I'll answer your question a little bit differently, Jared, and that is that what has happened in the U.S., with regard to oil and gas exploration and production, has been a backlash because of what I call fence line issues. So, from farmers, from even suburban homeowners who suddenly see a new oil and gas drilling rig in a pasture behind their house they don't own, but suddenly there's oil and gas production in their neighborhood that never occurred before. And that drilling rig may stay there for 2 months, 3 months, 6 months. And that kind of fence line issue from the noise, from the truck traffic, from the lights, the vibration, the dust, all of these things are valid concerns. And so there has been a backlash in some parts of the U.S. against the oil and gas industry that is valid. I don't perfectly understand why it has occurred. We've seen similar things in backlash against the wind industry because of the similar kinds of issues, of fence line issues, people looking out their window and suddenly seeing a 100-meter high wind turbine with red blinking lights that they're going to have to see all night, every night for the rest of their lives. They're mad, and I don't blame them.
Question here. We're getting to the end now, so yeah.
Robert, I have a question about your passions for the achievement of human ingenuity, particularly around innovation. Not so much about energy, but I think it was about 50 years ago, Richard Feynman delivered that address, There's Plenty of Room at the Bottom, and posed the question about 24 volumes of Encyclopedia Britannica on a pinhead, that sort of thing.
Sure.
Nanotechnology, things like that. What's the next big thing in innovation in your assessment? What's the thing that we could pin a lot of hope on?
Well, I think since we're coming up for time, it's a question of innovation that's in the topic of your talk, so we'll make this the last response.
Sure. A couple of things. What are the killer applications in energy? They've been the same for a long time. Super batteries, home-based fuel cell that's cheap, gas to liquids technology. We don't have any stranded oil deposits in the world. Anywhere there's oil that's been found on the globe, that oil has generally been exploited. Natural gas is a different story. We have stranded natural gas resources all over the world. In North Dakota, we were talking about this today at lunch. In April alone, in North Dakota, which is in the midst of a huge oil boom, in April alone, they flared, they just burned over 10 billion cubic feet of gas. Just burned it, because they don't have an economic use for it. If there were a way to turn that into methanol, ethanol, some other liquid, high-density liquid fuel at the wellhead, it's a killer application. But now what do I think is going to be the key technology going forward? For developing countries, I think even for Australia, it's going to be low-cost desalination. Lockheed Martin has developed a graphene oxide that they are claiming could reduce the energy inputs for desalination by 99%. That's a killer application because there are a lot of the areas in the world that are water short. And if we can create technologies and super low-cost, super efficient desalination, that's a big, big deal.
I think we'll leave it on that optimistic note. As I said, there are copies of Smaller, Faster, Lighter, Denser, Cheaper, and I'm sure the author, Robert Bryce, would be happy to sign them. It's great to have Mr. Bryce here today. It's a very important topic, as we all know in this room and beyond, that Australia's prosperity over 100 years and more has been very much built on the energy sector and cheap and efficient energy. And energy remains enormously important to the living standards of all Australians. So it's great to have here today, I guess you call yourself a glass half full man, but a realist talking about the issue of energy innovation and why the catastrophes have been wrong in the past, are wrong now, and will be wrong into the future. So congratulations on your book. I know it's been a great success internationally. I'm very pleased you've been able to find your way down to Australia to talk about it. It's already caused interest here, and I'm glad you gave one of your first major speeches to the Sydney Institute tonight, and well done, and thank you.
Thank you, Robert. Thank you. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.